Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And the headline across the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, Holdings Control 60% of Bank. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. An ownership shuffle at Raleigh-based First Citizens Bank shares has left CEO Frank B. Holding Jr., his parents and siblings, in control of nearly 60% of the $1.8 billion company's voting shares. The new alignment was outlined in First Citizens' most recent proxy statement filed with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The shuffle was touched off in December when longtime bank board member Carmen Holding Ames, daughter of former chairman Louis R. Snow Holding, who died in 2009, liquidated her stake in the $21 billion total asset bank. She also resigned her seat on the board. The Holding family, originally from Smithfield, has controlled First Citizens for three generations. Louis Snow Holding was the uncle of current CEO Frank Holding Jr., and the brother of Frank Holding Sr., who at 84, is no longer involved in day-to-day operations. Even so, it is the Frank Holding Sr. wing of the family that now has firm ownership control. According to the proxy, Frank Sr. and his wife Ella Ann hold 10.93% of the voting shares. His adult children follow, CEO Frank Jr. with 10.45%, Hope Holding Connell 9.33%, Olivia Holding of Smithfield 11.53%, Claire Bristow of Columbia, South Carolina, 7.97%, and Carson Holding Bryce of Smithfield, 7.8%. Only two institutional investors make the list of First Citizens' principal shareholders, including Boston-based Wellington Management with 3.35% of the voting shares scattered among its clients. The other is FMR LLC Fidelity Investments, also of Boston, with 720,501 Class A bank shares, but no voting power. I don't know of another bank of that size where the ownership is that concentrated, says banking expert and former industry regulator Don Coker, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. They have done a good job. First Citizens has two blocks of common stock, 8.6 million shares of Class A stock, and 1.639 million of shares of Class B stock. Holders of the Class A shares generally have one vote per share. Holders of the Class B stock have 16 votes for every share they own. Holding family members control nearly 34% of the Class A shares, but 71% of the more powerful Class B stock. The ownership domination of the Holding family is not new at the bank and is not a secret to investors who trade in First Citizens shares when they are available. But to at least one shareholder, Gerald Armstrong of Denver, Colorado, the current 16-vote per share arrangement for Class B has produced a power imbalance at the institution and a lack of accountability in the front office. In a proposal attached to the 2013 proxy, he seeks a full shareholder vote to do away with what he calls super voting. I just don't think we know what's going on at the top, says Armstrong, who was unsuccessful last year in a similar attempt to change how First Citizens directors are elected. As is his right, Mr. Armstrong has made another shareholder proposal, which has been submitted to our shareholders in accordance with our policies and SEC rules, First Citizens spokeswoman Barbara Thompson says. And now the rest of the front page of the Triangle Business Journal is under a red banner that goes across the page saying cover story. Then below that, there are two articles. First, there's one article that has a picture above it of the Raleigh Convention Center that opened in 2008. And then under that, it has the headline, Miss Targets, Despite Losses, Convention Center Officials Maintain Facility Success. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. When Raleigh city officials began planning to build a convention center in the new millennium, they said it would bring additional tourism dollars and help revitalize the downtown area. Supporters of the project and city government say they've accomplished that mission, but it's tough to judge that claim with hard numbers. Take the revenue and expense figures that the city reports for the facility. While the center's annual intake has barely changed in the last decade, including in the old facility, its expenses have increased about 50% during the same time. that has forced the city to redirect money from its collection of taxes on hotels, motels, restaurants, and bars. Since it opened in 2008, the RCC has pulled $56 million out of that special tax to cover operating losses. Also, beginning this year, the city will begin repaying the debt. This year and next year, it will pay a combined $19 million only for interest charges and begin paying down principal in 2015. By 2037, the convention center will pay $128 million of interest charges, bringing the true cost of the convention project to $371 million. If in any of those years the convention center can't cover the payments through its revenue or special tax, Raleigh taxpayers would be on the hook to cover the difference. Hidden value. There's more to grading a convention center than just revenue and expenses, however. Such facilities are built to attract people from out of town who eat at restaurants and stay in hotels, the main reason those industries pay the extra tax. Years ago, that tax even subsidized the downtown Marriott Hotel, meaning hotel owners directly subsidized the hotel to compete with them. It's difficult to judge whether the Raleigh Convention Center meets its stated goals. Projections showed the center would bring an additional 93,200 hotel room nights by the fourth year of operation from conventions, trade shows, and competitions. But the center booked only 65,766 room nights, about 30% less than projected. In addition, those represent only a fraction of the total hotel capacity in the county. Wake County had a supply of nearly 5.6 million room nights available in 2011, according to Smith Travel Research, a group that collects tourism data around the world. That measures the total rooms multiplied by the nights they are available in the year. Those directly attributable to the convention center make up barely more than 1% of the total supply. Robert Krupa, director of the RCC, says the numbers he tracks, meaning the 65,766 in his records, are those only directly attributable to hotel bookings made through his office. And there are probably other bookings that the city can't capture in hard data. Consider, for example, a group that attends a convention but books a hotel independently. He says he absolutely believes that the projected numbers are being met, even if he doesn't have a way to count them. Krupa says he realizes he's in between a rock and a hard place because he wants to report numbers he believes to be true, but if someone questions those numbers, he wants to give figures that he can back up with actual recorded bookings. He may have a case based on attendance figures. The same study that projected hotel bookings also projected total attendance. By that measure, the convention center has outperformed the projections, in some years by a fairly wide margin. In addition, the organization's paying the tax money, so they say they supported and continue to support the convention center. We understand the importance of the convention center, says Mark Latou, general manager of the Hyatt House near the airport and president of the Triangle Area Hotel Motel Association. He says the RCC brings in traffic that was going to other markets. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the project also has its critics. The John Locke Foundation, a conservative think tank, issued various critical reports both before and after construction. Subsidies are especially bad for events that would have taken place in Raleigh regardless of the availability of public convention center space, JLF Director of Communications Mitch Kokai says. In essence, taxpayers are forced to pick up the tab so that government planners can move meetings from one part of Raleigh to another. HVS, a facilities consulting company based in Chicago, projected the center's performance prior to its construction. It did a benchmarking study in 2012 to follow up. According to those estimates, the RCC falls 3% short of similar venues in terms of increasing total room nights to the area, though it actually outperforms them in terms of increasing the citywide number of room nights on a per-event basis, and also in terms of translating event attendance into more room nights. Revenue expense disconnect. Where the RCC mostly falls short is on the revenue and expense ledger. Convention center experts agree that these facilities don't usually turn a profit on their own. Indeed, Haywood Sanders, a preeminent expert in the field of convention centers, says there are probably fewer than 10 centers in the entire nation that directly return a profit to the city. Sanders, a professor of public administration at the University of Texas at San Antonio, judges the success of such centers by looking at trends in how much the centers lose. Here's where the RCC falls short of expectations. Revenue has fallen gradually over the years, but expenses have ballooned. Compared with similar centers, the RCC ranks 11% above average in total operating expenses, 19% above average in operating expenses per event, and 24% above average in operating expenses per attendee. Event service revenues are even further out of line with the average, meaning that the city must increasingly pull from a special tax to cover losses. Even so, Hyatt House's Latou says he and the organization he represents still support the RCC. Sanders says the convention business will grow only more competitive as many cities add their own centers. One of the largest and most well-known convention centers is McCormick Place in Chicago. That facility has seen its attendance cut in half from a high of 1.56 million in 2003 to 770,000 in 2011. The market out there is tough, he says. And we'll stop right there with this article as the rest of the article continues into a history of the Raleigh Convention Center. And now the other story that's part of this cover story section on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Durham's DPAC continues its profitable journey. And this article also written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Durham. Think of it as a shimmering playhouse that stands beacon-like at the core of what is emerging as a newer version of downtown Raleigh. The Durham Performing Arts Center not only packs in audiences in droves, it delivers another plus rarely found in public buildings, an annual profit. It stands, in fact, in stark juxtaposition to Raleigh's Convention Center, which gobbles up local and visitor taxes quicker than you can say, it's showtime. Granted, the two buildings have vastly different missions in many ways, but they opened at roughly the same time and in one key measure, both have the same mission, attract visitors to their city who will spend money in hotels, restaurants, and other such venues. But both do that to one degree or another. But the DPAC doesn't drain taxes. Indeed, it adds to the city of Durham's top line. Profits generated by the building have risen from $402,000 in 1999 to 1.8 million in 2012. DPAC drew almost 400,000 patrons in 2012, slightly lower from 2011 numbers, but more than two times higher than 2009 numbers. In 2011, the center ranked number four in the world in terms of attendance compared with similar facilities, according to entertainment industry magazine Pollstar. Attendance figures the magazine collects are self-reported, and not all theaters submit data. City help. Durham imposes a tax on hotels the same way Raleigh does, and uses revenue from that source combined with revenue from ticket sales to pay the debt service on DPAC. That facility cost $47 million compared to the $220 million price tag on the Raleigh Convention Center. Duke University contributed $7.5 million towards construction, and while it holds occasional events there, Michael Schoenfeld, Duke Director of Public Affairs, says the reason for the contribution was to enhance the civic and cultural life of the city. Talk to nearly anyone in connection to DPAC, and they will likely give the center resounding praise. Indeed, it has always returned money to Durham taxpayers and helped catalyze a revitalization. Talk about the DPAC wasn't always so rosy, however. In fact, while city leaders discussed the facility, many taxpayers voiced their objection to spending millions of dollars to build it. Durham is a participatory democracy. People like to participate here, says Bill Kalkoff, president of Downtown Durham Incorporated. You've got to give the mayor a lot of credit, given all the controversy. He said, keep going. Kalkoff was referring to Mayor Bill Bell, who freely admits that the extra tax would not have passed if they took the measure to a referendum. Instead, city leaders used similar certificate of participation financing that Raleigh used for the RCC. These bonds are backed by ticket sales and the hotel tax. This pleased Bell because the council did not put its city property taxes as backing for the bonds. In the RCC case, the Raleigh General Fund is the ultimate backstop, though in its short history, the RCC has not come close to requiring general fund money. Profitable venture. Durham owns the building and makes decisions on renovations and repairs. The city contracts with Niederlander Corporation, an agency in New York, which books all the shows. Per the contract, Durham receives 40% of the center's profit, which in 2011 amounted to $1 million. Niederlander keeps the remaining 60%. The contract is up for a renegotiation this year, but all sides have said they hope to reach a long-term deal to terms roughly the same as they exist today. We could not be happier in Durham, says Nick Skandalios, Executive Vice President, Niederlander. Importantly, he notes that Durham was wise to choose a partner early because that allowed Niederlander to give input on DPAC's design and what features or stage and seating dimensions would attract the best shows. He would not go as far as to say that Durham was the best relationship Niederlander has, because I don't want to diminish the other relationships, but added that I'll say that we could not ask for a better relationship. And now we'll read the biz section, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings. Snedeker gifts shirt through Millar. Golf pro Brant Snedeker may not have taken home the green jacket from the Masters Golf Tournament, but one lucky winner will be able to take home the Peter Millar jersey shirt that Snedeker wore in the final round April 14. Raleigh's Peter Millar also sponsors PGA Tour members Bill Haas and Harris English, but Snedeker was the one who made it to the top of the leaderboard in the third round. He ended up tying for sixth place, five shots behind Masters champion Adam Scott. Peter Millar, chairman and CEO Scott Mahoney, says the company had a great group of people working the tournament in Augusta, Georgia, but the best part, he says, was how Adam Scott and Angel Cabrera showed their respect for each other. The dogwood-colored shirt that Peter Millar is giving away will include all of Snedeker's formal tour sponsor logos, as well as an autograph across the front of the shirt. The shirt retails for $98.50. Bond's shaken not stirred line in dispute. James Bond must have liked cloudy cocktails. That was Biz's takeaway from a presentation by cocktail startup Bad Bad Cake at Research Triangle Park's recent RTP 180 event. Following up on the weird science theme for the evening, bartenders Alex Flynn and Matthew Bettinger explained the cocktail chemistry behind shaken versus stirred. It's a texture thing, Flynn explains. With clear liquids, you typically want to stir, no matter what James Bond says. Stirring a cocktail is not introducing air to it, he explains. That keeps the concoction from becoming cloudy. Think of crystal clear martinis. Billion phones play into Appia's vision. Appia CEO and local tech entrepreneur Judd Bowman seems to have the golden touch when it comes to starting new companies in the Triangle, but he says it's more about being in the right place at the right time. Responding to remarks by former Google CEO Eric Schmidt, who is also an investor in Appia, that Google's Android operating system is on track to be in 1 billion smartphones by the end of 2013, Bowman surmises that everyone in the world will be carrying a smartphone within the next 2 years. There are 6 billion phones in the world, Bowman says, so we're right here in the beginning. Appia specializes in mobile application discovery and is a distribution network. The company closed on a $5 million debt financing deal this week, led by North Atlantic Capital. Hikes, Durham building perfect for move. This time last year, Nuvatronic CEO Noelle Hikes didn't know she'd be moving her company's headquarters from Radford, Virginia to a new location in Durham. But she is, and will be bringing 25 to 30 employees and, of course, her two children. It wasn't the city that first attracted the defense contractor company, she says. It was one particular building. See, Nuvatronics creates 6-inch wafers for its technologies in Virginia. The company wants to build bigger wafers, 8 inches in diameter, and its Virginia facility wasn't big enough. Nuvitronics looked from California and all across the country before finding a building that would suit its needs, 2305 Presidential Drive in Durham. Details emerge on how MetLife deal was signed. Just 10 days after Governor Pat McCrory appointed Sharon Decker as the new Secretary of Commerce in January, she was thrust into action to save the state's chances at landing one of the biggest economic development deals to ever look at North Carolina. According to Commerce Department emails released this week in response to a public records request by Triangle Business Journal, a consultant for MetLife reached out to Decker's staff on January 13, attempting to find out whether North Carolina's new Republican leadership was still interested in a deal with MetLife. At stake was which community would capture 2,600 jobs and MetLife investments of more than $85 million. The company was also looking at sites in Rock Hill, South Carolina, and in Atlanta, Georgia. Leadership under former Governor Beverly Perdue had been working on a deal with MetLife for months, but apparently no one told Decker much about it. North Carolina won out in the end with an announcement in March that MetLife is splitting the project between Cary and Charlotte in exchange for an incentives package of nearly $100 million. Raleigh real estate development firm Community Smith is expanding into uptown Greenville. Led by Holton Wilkerson and Danny Cadis, Community Smith is finalizing plans to invest about $4 million in the redevelopment of a trio of historic buildings on Dickinson Avenue in Greenville. Contributing to biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Lauren Onsorge, and Lee Weisbecker. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. And the next one is headlined, Building a Better Plasma with Blessings from DOD. This article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Research Triangle Park. Dubbed Resussex, it's a finite dust with many of the properties of powdered milk. Only you don't add water, you add a specially prepared salt solution, and instead of milk, you get life-saving plasma. The plasma is atomized into fine droplets and into a stream of hot gas, nitrogen gas, Joe DeCorda, Chief Technology Officer at Integrion, explains. And the water is evaporated in milliseconds, leaving a fine ground powder, which is then collected. It's a fairly odd process, but one that could save lives, he says, particularly among those who suffer significant blood loss. Fueled by more than $60 million in U.S. Department of Defense grants and contracts, Integrion has been readying its spray-dried plasma product to enter the market later this year. The Department of Defense is interested because, unlike traditional plasma used in resuscitation, this plasma wouldn't need a freezer for storage, making it useful in the field. Resussex is similar, DeCorda says, to freeze-dried plasma that was used in World War II, but more efficient and safer. Its safety profile and convenience could attract an even bigger customer than the military, the global commercial market. That's where the Italian firm Kedrion comes in with a newly announced partnership in which it has licensed commercial rights to the technology. The deal entails an undisclosed equity investment by Kedrion in the Series C preferred stock of Integrion, which will occur incrementally throughout 2013. Through the deal, Integrion and Kedrion will jointly advance the product's clinical development while Kedrion will take over commercialization. Somewhere between 15 and 20% of the patients who currently need blood plasma for various reasons would benefit from an immediately available and safer blood plasma, DeCorda says. We think clinically that subset of patients in small or rural or under siege areas that don't have immediate access to a blood bank is one target area, and another is that subset of the population that is very, very ill and may have reactions to blood bank products. The product is pooled from the plasma of a large number of donors. The pathogens are removed through a solvent detergent process, explains Richard Martin, Executive Vice President of Integrion. That process filters out cellular debris, making the plasma safer than what's currently on the market, he says. But debris isn't the only thing that can be eliminated. What the solvent detergent treatment does is it inactivates enveloped viruses, says Mike Gallagher, Vice President of Operations overseeing product development, adding that enveloped accounts for most of the viruses that one can get through a blood transfusion. Due to the safety profile and the convenience, Antegrion's executives see a significant market, but couldn't commercialize with its 8 employees alone. That's where Kedrion comes in, Martin explains. Kedrion also acts as Antegrion's source of plasma. With blood shortages constantly being reported by the American Red Cross, Decorta sees the dried plasma as a future solution in the event of a crisis. And the Raleigh-Durham area isn't immune to blood shortages. Just last year, Rex Blood Services issued a call for help in the Triangle, citing critically low levels for certain blood types. Currently, Antegrion is only spray-drying plasma separated into blood types, and as it's about to enter Phase 1 trials, Resuscix is not currently available to supplement blood banks. Eventually, Antegrion plans to branch out to other products such as platelets. Antegrion also plans to research a universal donor product. And now we turn to A Better World, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And we have the column written by Todd Cohen. The headline on the column, Philanthropy Project Targets Latino Students, Families in the Triangle. By 2025, half the U.S. workforce, or more than 50 million workers, is expected to be of Latino descent. And 63% of U.S. jobs are expected to require some form of post-secondary education or training. Yet in the Triangle, Latinos are graduating from high school at lower rates than they are throughout North Carolina. To help improve their educational success, a public-private collaboration is working with Latino students and their families in the region. The goal is to make lasting change in systems that affect students, says Althea Gonzalez, North Carolina Program Manager for Oakland, California-based Hispanics in Philanthropy, or HIP. With a $600,000 four-year grant from the Indianapolis-based Lumina Foundation that it must match by raising another $200,000, HIP has developed a partnership to work with Latino students and families in Wake, Durham, and Johnston counties. To design the project, HIP teamed up with the Adelante Education Coalition, a broad-based statewide network that focuses on Latino education issues and policies from kindergarten through higher education. This school year, three agencies are working with 180 students at Millbrook High School in Raleigh, Durham Southern High School, and Smithfield Selma High School, and in a handful of Durham middle schools. Providing after-school programs and other support are Durham-based Student Action with farm workers in Johnston County, El Centro Hispano in Durham, and the North Carolina Society of Hispanic Professionals in Wake. Each after-school partner also hires a success coach to mentor and work with students on challenges they may face. And the Juntos program at North Carolina State University provides classes for parents and families on preparing children for college. Education is a family goal and not just the responsibility of students or parents, says Raul Gamez, Migrant Youth Director for Student Action with Farm Workers, who is helping to coordinate the Triangle Project. Success coaches typically provide a total of about 3 to 5 hours a week of support in addition to after-school activities that include tutoring and leadership development. The William and Ida Friday Institute for Educational Innovation at NC State is evaluating the project, and best practices from each county will be incorporated in all the programs, Gonzalez says. Working with the project is a leadership council that includes representatives of state and local public schools, public and private colleges and universities, state lawmakers, corporations and foundations, and media companies. After learning last year, for example, that Latino students at Georgia State University progressed over 7 years from graduating at the lowest rate among all ethnic groups to the highest rate, the council will be talking to officials at Triangle colleges and universities about identifying and adopting best practices. Gonzalez says addressing the issue is critical. This is not just the right thing or a moral thing to do, she says, but it is an economic imperative for North Carolina to get all of our kids of color, with Latinos as the expanding population, to get their graduation rates to improve. And in nonprofit news, Rebuilding Together of the Triangle, a nonprofit focused on home rehabilitation for low-income homeowners, has named new members to its board of directors. They include Erica Henning, Vice President of Real Estate-Owned Division at SunTrust Bank, Asa Fleming, broker at Coldwell Banker Advantage, Andrew Wall, Senior Associate at Alston & Bird, and Brian O'Haver, Raleigh Office Manager of Cole Genest & Stone. In the past 2 years, Rebuilding Together of the Triangle completed more than 40 projects at area homes with the help of more than 400 volunteers. The organization's projects were funded by local and national corporate sponsors, as well as by grants from its national headquarters in Washington, D.C. The Raleigh Rescue Mission has received a $1,000 grant. As part of the Restaurant Community Grants Program from the Darden Foundation, the charitable arm of Darden Restaurants Incorporated, the grants program, now in its second year, allows each restaurant in the Darden family of brands to award a $1,000 grant to support local community programs. The donation will help provide meals and snacks to 20 children served annually in Raleigh Rescue Mission's Children's Development Center, an on-site 5-star rated licensed preschool. And people on the move. Alliance for Historic Hillsboro hired Chris Holiday as marketing coordinator. He has 15 years of experience as a copywriter, content manager, and photo editor. Amy Bridges, Director of Corporate Relations at Rocky Top Hospitality, was named to the Greater Raleigh Merchant Association and Shop Local Raleigh's Board of Directors. Now returning to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The next article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Morrisville, the headline, Impressive Cash Out of Stock Options. Share prices have rebounded strongly from the depths of early 2009, and their especially steep rise since autumn has prompted Triangle executives to cash in millions of dollars in company stock. The S&P 500 index has risen by about 8% since the end of September. Shares of several companies in the Triangle have shot up much faster. Cree Incorporated, the Durham-based lighting company, has more than doubled as it rolls out an ultra-efficient LED light bulb at a price that makes sense for some consumers. The pharmaceutical companies Salix and Furiex have risen by 16% and 73%, respectively. Even companies in mature industries have done well. First Citizens Bank shares is up 13%, and the aggregates giant Martin Marietta Materials is up 14%. Executives and board members have responded by exercising options to buy company stock and selling the shares. Some have raked in hundreds of thousands of dollars in a day. One of the biggest winners has been Cree CEO and Chairman Chuck Swoboda, whose options netted him a cool $1 million on March 5. Martin Marietta Chairman Stephen Zelnak and retiring executive Bruce Vio respectively sold $2.1 million and $2.8 million in shares in late 2012. Those amounts don't represent pure gain as Swoboda's does, but Zelnak and Vio still came out several hundred thousand ahead if they had acquired the shares in the last couple of years. From those companies to the carry software developer SideQuest and Highwoods Properties, the Raleigh-based commercial landlord, many of the shares now being sold were initially awarded as options. An option is the right to buy a share at a predetermined price, which can represent a deep discount for an exec whose company has been doing very well. Options and other share-based pay are aimed at rewarding execs for good performance, and they frequently account for half of top execs' total compensation. That fact has been on display in April as companies report top executives' pay packages to investors via annual proxy statements. At SideQuest, for example, options accounted for nearly two-thirds of CEO Stephen Wee's $1.9 million total compensation last year. Companies use a standard accounting formula to calculate the values of options as they're awarded. although it's usually several years before an executive realizes the gain or even knows how big it will be. And our next article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the headline, SJF bags $75 million in new gunpowder. Green and socially conscious startup investor SJF Ventures expects to put the finishing touches on its third investment fund by the end of the month. With an original target of $75 million, SJF's new war chest is expected to be oversubscribed, with all of the cash coming from private sector sources. Among the investors are Citigroup and Deutsche Bank. We've always found that if you can get all of your money from private sources, it ends up with a lot fewer requirements attached, SJF founder and managing director David Kirkpatrick says, adding that he'll have more to say when the fund closes in a couple of weeks. One of the few Triangle Area venture operations that has ever even attempted to raise new money in recent months, SJF has put in a textbook performance, selling the first shares of its third fund in March 2012. It said had pulled in 65% of the target by early 2013 and had a clear line on where the rest of the money would be coming from. Other institutional investors include Calvert Equity Portfolio, Armonia, Abacus Sustainable Fund, Trillium Asset Management, the Caprock Group, Open Box, and Impact Assets. The fund's closing will bring total cash under management at SJF to $120 million. Kirkpatrick says SJF has already started using the new money to make startup investments, including the lead position it recently took in the $6 million venture infusion into Aseptia, a manufacturer with locations in Raleigh and Troy, North Carolina. Using technology developed at North Carolina State University, Aseptia has developed a packaging system to preserve food without the use of chemicals. It was SJF's first Triangle investment. And we would be delighted if we were able to make more, Kirkpatrick says. Since launching in 1999, SJF has invested in 34 sustainable businesses whose technologies range from solar energy to supply chain efficiency and wastewater irrigation. The venture group's fundraising record, investment history, and optimistic future plans leave it bucking recent trends in the wider green and clean tech investing sector. Over the last three quarters, in fact, the flow of venture dollars into that space has narrowed dramatically, from $1.4 billion in the second quarter of 2012 to $408 million in the first quarter of 2013, says Jonathan Sherry of the online venture tracking company CB Insights. I wouldn't say that the sector has tanked, but it's certainly headed downhill for now, he says. Roadway solutions spark researchers. This article is written by Lauren Onsorge. The new James B. Hunt Library at North Carolina State University isn't just a place to read about innovation. It's a place to do the innovating. That's according to two university researchers who, during a tour of the library, were inspired to expand their own project, one that eventually took them out of the library. Bastian Schroeder, Assistant Director of Highway Programs for NC State's Institute for Transportation Research and Education, was touring the library with research assistant Jeffrey Chang when they stumbled onto new 3D printers. Our office is on Central Campus, Schroeder says. We were literally just touring the library to see what it's all about. The pair was already involved in a national research project aimed at helping identify traffic crossing solutions, particularly roundabouts, the problem they were trying to fix, helping blind people navigate roundabouts. With roundabouts being so different from a standard 90-degree intersection, that makes it difficult, especially if they have literally never seen it before, Schroeder says. The 3D printer presented the pair with an opportunity. What if there was a way blind people could learn what to expect from a roundabout prior to a site visit? That's where the printer came in. The pair designed a tactile roundabout map and pushed print. That's three different layers for three different elevations, Chang explains. A base layer to symbolize pavement, a layer for a walkway, and another for boundaries such as the roundabout's island. And it worked. The pair has taken the map out of the library and placed it into the hands of blind students who have been able to navigate the roundabouts on campus. It's part of a national project aimed at studying the pros and cons of roundabouts. Chang calls the tactile map more of a training and education tool than a commercial project, but it could still further an argument his team has been making that roundabouts are an efficient roadway solution. We're trying to encourage the implementation of roundabouts in general, he says. Research into contingencies, such as use by the hearing impaired, is another tool in pushing for that implementation, he says. While tactile maps are nothing new, they aren't typically customized for roundabouts. Over the next few months, the pair plans to perform studies of roundabouts throughout the nation, and it all started with the library. The 3D printers are just one of the high-tech features there. Others include the famous BookBot program and recording labs with green screens that allow a scene to be superimposed over a different background. Since its opening earlier this year, the library has been ranked as one of the 25 coolest college libraries in the world by the lifestyle magazine Complex. And the spotlight section that we come to now in the Triangle Business Journal has the spotlight on manufacturing. The first article, Chinese firm pick Triangle for manufacturing. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. Two Chinese manufacturers of radio frequency identification tags, also known as smart labels, have made heavy capital investments in the Triangle in recent months after each opened a new manufacturing facility in the region. Invengo Technology Corporation, a 16-year-old company based in Shenzhen area next to Hong Kong, opened a production facility in the North Raleigh building in January. There, the company is already producing both inlay and tag RFID products for clients across the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, Executive Vice President Joe Grimillion says. Hong Kong-based competitor SML Group Limited has also opened a production facility in Clayton, where it will be making three of the company's inlay products sold to brands in the apparel industry. SML acquired U.S. label manufacturer CPG Labels in July 2012 and has been increasing its capacity for RFID tag development and production, according to the trade publication RFID Journal. RFID Journal founder and editor Mark Roberti says Invengo is one of the largest RFID tag producers in the world, with more than 300 employees in China. Still, the company was relatively unknown in the Americas until it opened a sales office in Virginia in 2009. Roberti says Invengo used to be one of the only Chinese companies to attend the journal's annual conference event. This year, at least a dozen Chinese companies have registered. The RFID industry struggled after the financial collapse in 2008 because companies curtailed investments in new technologies, Roberti says. Now the technology has improved, the benefits have been proved, and the industry is starting to see solid growth. Gomillion has been in the RFID industry for about 8 years and joined Invengo about a year ago. Anywhere in the U.S. would have worked for this plant, but I told them that I wasn't going to move anywhere else, says Grimillion, who lives in North Raleigh. So far, Invengo has hired 9 people for its Raleigh production and sales facility, and Grimillion anticipates that he'll need to add additional shifts before the end of the year. I don't know if we'll ever be as big as China is in volume, but we'll be big enough to handle the local market, he says. And by local market, Grimillion means all of North America, South America, and parts of Europe. Most of the company's production, he says, is automated but highly specialized. Finding skilled workers has been difficult. It will probably take a full year for us to develop the expertise we need for 8 to 10 hour shifts, but I can totally see this quadrupling as the technology is adopted in the market. RFID technology has over the past several years been introduced to all types of retailers, retail brands, and other companies seeking ways to better track their supply chains and increase efficiency. The labels, which can be attached to just about any package, tag, or box, use electromagnetic fields to transfer data. Libraries have started to use RFID tags to keep track of volume inventory. Macy's department store is testing RFID technology to eliminate cashier lines. Invengo and SML Group are also following the lead of other Chinese manufacturing companies, like the computer maker Lenovo and the small engine manufacturer RATO Power. They are opening production facilities in North Carolina to better serve their customers in North America by cutting shipping costs from Asia and speeding up deliveries to customers. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal is in the small business section. The headline, 7 years in, couple on their way to jumpstart learning business. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. Prepare for an assault of color and a bit of sensory overload when entering Stone's Education Superstore in Raleigh. There are puppets and puzzles, games and gadgets, arts and crafts of every kind. Just about every square inch of floor space, wall space, and ceiling space in the 10,000 square foot showroom is filled or decorated with educational materials targeting the early childhood and elementary school age groups. For decades, Stones has been a go-to place for teachers and educators from around the region. But when husband and wife team David and Carol Madison took over the business in 2005, one of their main objectives was to appeal also to parents, caregivers, and others involved in the education of children. The biggest misnomer out there is we are only for teachers, David Madison says. We are not. So they first changed the name of the business from Stone School Supply Company to Stone's Education Superstore, though it's legally incorporated as Stone School Supply Incorporated. Then they dedicated additional floor space to items that would appeal to those outside the professional education world, but not at the expense of their teacher customer base. We just crammed more items in, Carol Madison says, estimating they doubled the store's inventory within the first 18 months and now carry about 20,000 stock keeping units from 300 vendors at both the Raleigh store and on its website. Neither David nor Carol Madison, who relocated to the Triangle in 2001, had a background in education prior to buying the business in 2005, but they say their career backgrounds have probably better prepared them for the rigors of retail. Carol used to be a buyer for Macy's department stores, and David was in mortgage banking. I'm a merchant at heart, Carol Madison says. He's the finance guy. It takes both of those things to make it a success. David Madison was at first skeptical when an opportunity came to buy Stones from its previous ownership group that included members of the original Stone family and former and current employees. But Carol, who has been an active volunteer with her children's school PTA, regularly shopped for items from their teachers' wish list at places like Stones. I know what teachers want and need, and when I walked in here, it was like being a kid in a candy store, she says. You just don't see a lot of these things in other places. Stones had annual sales of around $1.1 million when the Madisons took over in 2005, he says, and they built that number to $1.8 million within 3 years. Revenue ebbed to around $1.575 million in 2011, but the Madisons say they have been seeing improvement. Later this year, David Madison will fulfill his main objective since buying the business, moving Stones out of the drafty warehouse building that it's occupied since the mid-1970s, and relocated into a new energy-efficient building that he's been planning in his head since day one. The Madisons purchased land in Cary near the intersection of Trinity Road and Chapel Hill Road 3 years ago and have been working ever since on the plans for the $3.5 million building. It's expected to open by December 2013. The deal has been able to come together, they say, because of the network of local civic leaders, bankers, and business people that the couple has met since moving to the region. They secured a construction loan for nearly $2.9 million from Raleigh-based Vantage South Bank after meeting former RBC Bank executive Steve Jones several years ago at a Carolina Hurricanes event in Raleigh. Jones is now president of Vantage South. Rufty Peden, Commercial Design Build of Raleigh, will be the general contractor for the project. Stephen Peedland, president of the firm, helped the Madisons find a buyer for an outparcel lot next to their Cary site, that made it possible for them to get the bank loan. It's all about interactive relationships and putting all together and pulling all together, Piedland says. 2004 medical malpractice case against Duke can continue. This article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Durham. The North Carolina Court of Appeals on April 16 handed down a partial loss to Duke University relating to a medical malpractice case from 2004. An appellate panel reinstated a medical malpractice lawsuit by a man who complained that a surgical procedure at the university hospital failed to alleviate pain and numbness in his arm. The surgery involved removal of a rib, and the man said he discovered later that the surgeon had removed a different rib than had initially been discussed. A court in Durham County threw out the suit in late 2011, ruling that the plaintiff hadn't been able to show that the doctor and hospital may have fallen short of the appropriate standard of care. But the appeals court disagreed on April 16, saying that the man had given enough information for the lawsuit to go forward. And now we turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. European software firm to expand Triangle HQ operations. GFI Software is moving and expanding its U.S. headquarters in the Triangle on the heels of filing for a $100 million initial public offering in November. GFI, based in Luxembourg, will be moving its office operations in Cary to the Winchester Place building in Durham's Imperial Center Office Park after recently signing a lease to occupy 16,466 square feet. David Kelleher with GFI Software says the company's lease at its current premises at 15300 Weston Parkway in Cary, where it occupied about 12,000 square feet, is expiring. He would not disclose how many people the company employs in the Triangle, but in 2009 the company had about 270 people in the region. As of September, GFI employed 919 people across all of its offices around the world. In the U.S., GFI also has office operations in Florida and California. GFI Software SA, in November, filed an initial public offering, hoping to raise $100 million after posting $135 million in sales for the 12 months that ended June 30, 2012. About 41% of its bookings come from clients in North America and South America. Raleigh to get $1.26 million Interpretive Visitor Center. Raleigh City Council on Tuesday tapped a hometown firm, Centurion Construction Company, to build a $1.26 million Interpretive Visitor Center at Mordecai Park off Wake Forest Road. The two-story, 4,700-square-foot building will include a multi-purpose room, reception area, gift shop, and exhibit galleries, and will be used for various interpretive displays and educational programs, the city says in a release on the project. The second floor will be used for archives and employee office space. The building design is intended to be in keeping with the historic context and architectural characteristics in the surrounding area, the city says. Durham's Main Street getting $25 million apartment project. Durham will soon see more apartments rising along Main Street. Charlotte real estate developer Crescent Communities expects to break ground in mid-June on another major apartment community in central Durham, a $25 million project called Crescent Main Street. Crescent has been negotiating to buy a four-acre lot owned by Durham businessman Terry Sanford Jr., bound by West Main Street, 15th Street, and Rutherford Street, and it has selected Raleigh construction firm Clancy & Thays to build the four-story project, according to construction documents from the Carolinas AGC. Russell Allen out as Raleigh City Manager. The Raleigh City Council voted Wednesday morning not to renew the contract of 12-year City Manager Russell Allen. "We appreciate all he has done to help Raleigh become an award-winning municipality," the council said in a prepared statement headlined, Council to Take New Direction. Just as Raleigh has grown and changed, so have the skills needed to manage and grow the city. Russell is expected to stay through July 1. The legacy of Raleigh City Manager J. Russell Allen, whose contract wasn't renewed on Wednesday, has to include an impressive list of changes that came to downtown Raleigh over the past dozen years. The Raleigh Convention Center, the Fayetteville Street Mall, the city's contribution toward the construction of what's now known as the PNC Tower, all of which Russell helped bring about, sparked an inner city renewal that continues today. Of all the leaders who helped make Raleigh rated number one, Russell Allen worked the hardest and the most, says former Mayor Charles Meeker. During his term, Raleigh has expanded its park's acreage by 50%. The city's population grew from less than 300,000 to more than 420,000 over the course of his tenure. And in our last minute, we'll give you the results of the Triangle Business Journal web poll. They had 420 responses to the question of, will the overhaul of the North Carolina Commerce Department benefit the state's economy? And the results were 45% say yes, public-private partnership works better. 49% say no, partnerships like this may create unwanted problems. And the rest had a sign marking of don't care. And let's see, the next poll will be, how would you grade Governor McCrory's first 100 days in office? But we'll leave that until next week. For right now, we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.